Hi, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and I'm here to warn you that the audio on the following interview is a little bit dodgy. The reason has to do with very high traffic on the internet in India, actually in Mumbai, after the July 13th terror attack. Anyway, we're sorry the audio isn't very good, but we hope you enjoy the interview.
Good day, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. Professor Vinayak Chaturvedi of the University of California, Irvine, is going to talk to us about his book, Peasant Pasts, History and Memory in Western India, specifically Gujarat. That is one place that has punched above its weight when it has come to sending forth nationalists against the colonial state. The Mahatma and the Sardar were from Gujarat, and Muhammad Ali Jinnah was, by ethnicity, a Gujarati. But there were others, peoples and communities fighting against state structures in their own way and incurring the disapprobation of the mainstream, a dominant nationalist in the process. The Tharalas of the Kheda district were one such group. Peasants took up cudgels not only against the British, but also against the local elites, with millenarian preachers, legends, and late-night raids all thrown in for effect. Never mind that their uprisings were promptly quashed by the local authorities. What is important, Professor Chaturvedi stresses, is that they knew how to confiscate, collect, preserve, produce, and distribute information in forms comprehensible to the colonial state, that is to say, written records, despite having had very little formal education themselves. We'll let Vinayak take over now and talk about his research in the colonial archives and his wanderings among the descendants of these people.
Good morning, Professor Chaturvedi.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, and thanks for doing this for the New Books Network. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad you were able to have a conversation about the book.
But before the book, could you tell us something about yourself and about your career to date?
Sure. I began my graduate studies at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. And at the time, I was very interested in economic history and was working with Robert Brenner, who wrote the very famous series of arguments about the transition from feudalism to capitalism. And my interest initially in thinking about agrarian India was to address some of those concerns within the contemporary debates within India. In the process of being in graduate school, I also was reading agrarian history was influenced by cultural history, mainly someone like Carlo Ginzburg. And then also, it was also a time where the writings of the subalternists, especially Partha Chatterjee, were coming out. And what I found was very interesting was that one of the earliest pieces that Partha Chatterjee wrote about was an engagement with the writings of Robert Brenner, and really looking at the arguments of political Marxism within the context of what the subalternists were trying to do. And for me, that sort of the link between what my earlier interests in thinking about Brenner's arguments about political Marxism, Partha Chatterjee's arguments, and also the writings of Carlo Ginzburg, although on Italy, in the 16th century, provided a very interesting way of thinking about the possibilities of writing agrarian history in India. And so that's what really got me sort of excited about the prospect of doing a different kind of project within the field of agrarian history in South Asia.
So what made you pick Gujarat State as the site for this research?
Well, I would say that it was, after I finished my master's at UCLA, I ended up going to Cambridge in England to do another master's. And at the time I was working with Chris Bailey. And my interest initially was to work on princely states in central India. So mainly starting with Gwalior, but also the many smaller princely states in central India. However, there were a couple major issues in doing a larger project on central India, namely that the Scindia family, because of was in a legal battle, the court had sealed all the documents, which made it very difficult to sort of think of a project, realizing that you may not have access to a series of types of documents related to land holdings and agrarian society. And at the time, because I was only doing a one-year master's in Cambridge, Chris Bailey had suggested thinking about Gujarat, because Gujarat being so important, but yet the historiography was very limited at the time, outside, you know, the works of a handful of, you know, very important works by, you know, whether it was Douglas Haynes or David Hardiman, and even of an earlier generation of scholars, Makran Mehta and others who were writing on Gujarat. But he thought that this was, I could address the kind of conceptual theoretical questions I had about agrarian society, but addressing it within the Gujarat context. And once I started working on the Gujarat project, in a certain sense, it took a life of its own. And what I was doing in terms of the kind of material I was finding was quite fascinating. So in a sense, I ended up staying in Gujarat versus going back to my original project on central India.
So could you tell us something about the research and the book in a nutshell?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think what emerged out of that one-year project was I was looking at famines at the end of the 19th century and looking at a larger sort of pan-Gujarati project. But what became really interesting and evident was that that within central Gujarat, in the area between Ahmedabad and Baroda, was an area which, you know, for example, David Hardiman and others have written about, Judith Brown as well, in terms of this area providing sort of a great deal of support for Gandhi's mass politics in the 20th century. So that historiography was extremely well documented and well written. In addition, this was an area that a lot of economic historians and also demographers were writing about as well in tracking the development of capitalism within agrarian society with cotton, with tobacco, with other kinds of sort of cash crops. And that historiography was also well developed. What I also found in my process of doing the research was that this is an area that was classified as one of the most criminal areas in Western India. And so I began to think about what were the relationships between capitalist development, nationalism, and criminality. And I think that's what really got me sort of thinking about, you know, what were the other possibilities of the kind of work that could be done within agrarian society, looking at the types of politics, especially of those who did not make it on sort of the, you know, the academic radar, sort of low caste groups, tribals, Dalits, and others who clearly had a politics of their own in the period of these major transformations that were taking place within colonialism and nationalism. So in a sense, that's what got me interested in thinking about that there must be an alternate history of this area that goes beyond sort of the configuration that we sort of knew at the time. So that's what got me, I think, really interested in thinking about the project.
Yeah, you mentioned finding a reference to the Dharala groups in the colonial archives in Bombay. So could you elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. Well, actually, the main record that I found was actually in the official publications room in the Cambridge University Library. And it was an obscure police report in which a police inspector, if I'm remembering correctly, was writing that that the patidars, the sort of the elite landed community that had power in the countryside, was using its power to extract labor and abusing a legislation called the Criminal Tribes Act in 1918. And I thought this was kind of an interesting moment because 1918 was also the year where Gandhi is having his satyagraha in Kheda district at the same time. So it made me sort of really think that at one level, what is the politics of the Dharalas, what is their standing within agrarian society by which you have these populars who are at one level siding with Gandhi, Gandhi's looking for their support in this period as a way to mobilize agrarian society. But the largest agrarian population was of these Dharalas, which constituted about approximately a third of the population in this district. And what was happening to them, that they were being not only marginalized by both the colonial project, but also by these early forms of nationalism in Kheda district. So in a certain sense, that's what really triggered an interest in sort of thinking about, well, what is this alternate history of the Dharalas by which these Patidars are finding that it's necessary to control labor? And that's what got me thinking about this earlier history of the 19th century, that these Dharala populations must have had a range of arguments and ideas. And here I'm building upon Carlo Ginzburg's, that this alternate history of ideas of peasants that allows them to really protest, allows them to articulate their own sets of concerns about the world that they live in, that even figures like Gandhi, who would acknowledge that the Patidars, for example, were abusing labor and controlling labor of groups like the Dharalas, but yet he was not, I would argue, as I've argued in my book, was not interested in sort of challenging that structure to allow the Dharalas that space to articulate their own sets of ideas and politics.
Why do you think that was the case?
I'm sorry?
Why do you think that was the case? You know, that Gandhi, he didn't like really encourage the Dharalas to like create their own space.
Well, I think I mean, if you look at the historiography of UP, and others have written about this as well, that, you know, that when it came to various issues of class and things, that Gandhi often didn't side with the workers, didn't side with the peasants, didn't side with the marginal, for a range of different kinds of arguments that he was proposing. I mean, one could look at, for example, Hind Swaraj and his arguments within Hind Swaraj and sort of say, well, he begins to articulate that it is the necessity of the oppressed, of the persecuted, to forgive their oppressors. And in a sense, one could extend it at that level. But on more practical political terms, one could also argue that Gandhi was not interested in making those kinds of arguments at that specific time, in thinking through, you know, what were the possibilities of creating alliances with Patidars for the betterment of the nation. I mean, at one level, when he's talking to the Dharalas in speeches to the Dharalas in the 1920s or even the 1930s, he's asking the Dharalas to, you know, to forgive their oppressors, to forget past problems, to forget past conflicts as a way to building a stronger nation. So I mean, there are multiple ways I think one could interpret Gandhi's arguments, as many scholars have done through the decades. So I would say that it's very difficult to know exactly, but I think it's somewhere in between these sets of arguments that Gandhi was proposing.
Yeah, something for the greater common good of the people, like you might make some sacrifices, something like that.
Possibly, but he also knew that that the Dharalas were also interested in other forms of protest. They argued for certain types of ethics of violence, which he found fundamentally problematic at this point. And their desire to contest the nationalist movement meant for Gandhi that they didn't understand politics. I've argued in the book that, you know, at one level, what Gandhi is really, what these Dharalas are really trying to do is provide an alternate form of a political community. Unfortunately, we don't know the exact contours of that political community, but at another level, we do know that that there were these alternate ways in which not just peasants, but others were imagining political community that wasn't just about nationalism, which wasn't just about the nation state, there were other forms that were in existence at the time. So I think it was also a way of moving beyond these other forms of political community, which could be numerous and plural, to thinking about a more unified way of thinking about political community vis-a-vis the nation. I think that's what I would argue. And it's not just my argument. I'm sort of building upon the arguments of figures like Benedict Anderson, who've made similar kinds of claims in his, you know, famous book, Imagined Communities, that you have the existence of many different kind of imagined communities, but it's the imagined community of the nation vis-a-vis the nation state that wins out in the end in the 20th century. So I would sort of argue that. And I think the other thing that is really important to consider, which the historiography on South Asia hasn't fully developed, is the significance of princely states. Because these peasants were also aware of the existence of the many princely states, the princes and kings, the maharajas and the smaller rajas, who in many ways thought of themselves as being legitimate leaders in opposition to or in contrast to what the British were doing in terms of their kind of colonial policies. And so in a certain sense, I would argue that it wasn't that these peasants were feudal in thinking about kings as a form of legitimate statecraft, but rather an alternative form of politics that were already in existence in India at the time. And I don't think we have to look at just the highest kings and princes and princely states, but actually all the way down to the lowest levels in terms of what is it about kingship and legitimate government and ethical government that these peasants were really trying to articulate. And I would argue from that vantage point.
Actually, going back to the Dharalas, could you just tell us something more about them as a group and the socio-cultural setting in which they operated?
Yeah, I mean, now the term Dharala is, you know, there's a debate by language scholars in terms of, if you look at the first part of Dharala, which is derived from Dhar or Dhara, the edge of a sword, literally. So what I've argued is that these Dharalas were swordsmen in the 18th, 17th century. They were swordsmen who protected, for example, pilgrimage routes, protected bazaars, and, you know, figures like William Pinch and others have written about these ascetic warriors, and I would argue that they fit into that larger kind of category of individuals who had certain rights to land, certain rights within agrarian society for their service to previous governors of the land, especially in terms of protecting various routes and things like that. In the 19th century, what we begin to see is the East India Company after 1803 is really interested in settling these Dharalas into sort of cultivating groups. And in many ways, they were already cultivators, often practicing shifting cultivation. And the interest of the East India Company at the time was to figure out a way to settle them as a way to begin to start taxing them. And I would say that in the larger project of the 19th century of doing this happens. So the Dharalas in many ways are forced to abandon all sorts of occupations, especially by 1857, for example, the entire community is banned from possessing weapons as a way to prevent sort of the rebellions of central and eastern India after spreading into Gujarat. And the Dharalas by the end of the 19th century are mostly settled peasant group. In terms of caste, I think they're typically identified because they fall into the larger category of Koli of Gujarat, typically seen as a low caste peasant community. And they're quite populous. I mean, in the sense that, as I pointed out, there about one third of the population in central Gujarat. Their populations also spread in other parts of Gujarat. But it is by the end of the 19th century when you begin to see the effects of this devastating famine in which the Ralas lose about, you know, anywhere between 15 to 20% of their population. The plague epidemic that follows, you begin to see large numbers of the Ralas who are pushed off the land or forced to leave the land. And suddenly there's actually a crisis within agrarian society because there's very few cultivators to cultivate the land. And it's at this moment where you begin to see the rise of the Rala movements to demanding cash payments, more labor rights, land rights that are taking place at this time.
So you mentioned that they had a relationship with the Patidars in which they ended up getting abused by the Patidars. So how did that come to happen?
Again, many of these Daralas in the 19th century were already working as either sub-tenants, agricultural laborers, oftentimes servants of many Patidars. But on the other end, you find caste manuals of various Darala groups and others like the Daralas who were intermarrying with Kandis, who are formed the agrarian cultivators of what are now known as Patidars. So you had a greater stratification among cultivators, even among Patidars, who were intermarrying among Daralas. But there's a fundamental, what I argue in my book is, there's a fundamental shift that takes place in the 19th century due to a range of British policies, as well as the functioning of the Patidars to consolidate themselves as a community in villages. And it's that consolidation which becomes a way to start controlling agrarian society at all levels, whether it's controlling bullocks or whether it's controlling land or whether it was controlling labor. And it's when at the end of the 19th century, when you begin to see that Patidars are losing their control over the Daralas, it's immediately in that period where the Daralas are beginning to articulate certain demands that the Criminal Tribes Act is imposed and greater controls over the Darala labor are instituted. So I would argue that there is this interesting and complex nature of agrarian society that has developed in the 19th century, which led to kind of the implications of the 20th century in central Gujarat.
So actually that brings us to Ranchor Veera. And would you say that he actually symbolized everything about the Darala's political aspirations at the time?
I would say he was one of the figures. He's one of the figures that we know because of the kind of evidence that remains regarding his movement. As I pointed out, there were other figures like Ranchor Veera in the early parts of the 20th century who we don't know about, except for their names and their desires to create a different kind of political order in the countryside. But I think he reflects a larger kind of sentiment not just in Gujarat, but I think throughout India. And I would say that this is something that Ranjit Gua in his book, Elementary Aspects of Peasant Insurgency, identifies, which he doesn't fully develop in the work, but I think is a very important observation, is that of the 110 or so rebellions that take place in the 19th century, what you find is that most of the rebellions were led by low-caste bhagats, these low-caste village priests who were leading these movements, and most of the time they were Vaishnav bhagats. So the question for me in thinking about Ranchod is how does he fit into this larger project of, and I wouldn't say it's a unified project, but larger sets of concerns by these bhagats that there's something fundamentally problematic that's not ethical, that's not legitimate about the ways in which statecraft is functioning all over India. And if we look at all these movements together, what we begin to see is not simply the rebellion, I would argue, but really marking a certain kind of claim about both ethics and legitimacy that scholars really haven't fully, I think, developed, because Peasant movements have typically just been seen as these sort of short-ended movements, whereas I've tried to argue that if we look at them within the context of intellectual movements, of religious movements and political movements, what you see is a very different kind of argumentation that's being proposed by these bhagats. Now, the big problem of studying bhagats, of course, is that's part of an oral tradition that's not written. So we only have access to certain aspects of what they may be thinking. Or Dadaram, you know, is a figure who comes very close from where Ranchodvira is from in Gujarat, basically about 2 or 3 miles away. And what's interesting about Ranchod's movement was that he collected as many Dharala Bhagats as he could and as a way to holding various kinds of political meetings with them. And after Ranchod's movement, what we begin to see is that he is arrested and then dies very quickly. But during the moment of his arrest, he wants to engage with the police inspector as a way of engaging with, I argue, as a way of engaging with sort of the named representative of the colonial government. He sees himself as a legitimate king who wants to engage, and he's completely dismissed. His movement is squashed. But what's also interesting was that, you know, he was circulating all these letters, which I found were also circulating all over India. So he is a figure who is participating in this kind of order to provide a certain kind of critique of the colonial state. And what struck me as really interesting is that even though he's arrested and he dies, what the colonial government notices is that his letters continue to spread, questioning the colonial state's legitimacy to exist. And this poses a major threat. What struck me was, again, I wasn't interested in the fact that his movement didn't last, but what I was interested in was thinking about how ideas that he's proposing and his supporters were proposing circulate over and over again, not just in among other Dharala supporters, but in the larger area of Gujarat. And these letters end up in Baroda, they end up in neighboring principal states. By 1906, we see that there's this figure, Dadaram Bhagat, who's also he's questioning the legitimacy of the colonial government, but in a certain sense, he's acting like a king. He provides food for the poor. He provides certain kinds of relief. He provides certain kinds of critiques of the government, but he's not seen as a threat to the colonial order. But in many ways, is one could see him as an interesting successor to Dadaram. And what to the earlier Bhagat. But you also have, I would argue, these are the ones that we know about. There is a world of ideas and sets of figures that we simply don't know about. And what I've argued in the book as a methodological concern for historians is that, you know, we would like to have documents and records. But at another level, what's interesting is the possibilities of other ways of thinking that simply have gone unrecorded. And at this time, that's all oftentimes we can say, that there are these possibilities. And that's, in many ways, what has excited me about the work is to think about, you know, what are the other ways in which people are thinking about their existence in the colonial world, in this period of great transformation of both demographic crisis, but also the emergence of nationalism.
So I understand that you've made a couple of research trips to Gujarat to track down and talk to the descendants of both Ranchod and Dadaram. So could you tell us something about your experiences? Because this was actually talking about local history to people who might not actually get the significance of what you're talking about, because they might actually end up undervaluing their own movements. Did you get a sense of that?
What struck me as very interesting is, for example, with Dadaram's descendants, I would say these are his intellectual descendants, I would argue, his religious disciples in other ways, see themselves in many ways as transforming the kind of normative narratives of nationalism. taking themselves very seriously and sort of wanting to participate and as part of now the national project. So thus far, they have been, you know, you can walk around central Gujarat, go to most villages in central Gujarat, which there are any kind of Patidar presence, and what you see is Patidar leadership, Gandhi, the Congress is what is often celebrated in these villages. But when you talk to these descendants of figures like Bhadurang, they too want to participate in this national project that they were that they see as having been excluded from for nearly a century. And in their kind of oral narratives, especially this one oral narrative about the place of Gandhi, they see that Bhadurang was one of Gandhi's teachers. That Gandhi himself becomes a disciple in their narrative. So in a certain sense, they're overturning the normative narrative of Gandhi into a very different kind of narrative. Now, one might say, well, why is this important or why is this relevant? They don't just do it for Gandhi. They do it, for example, when it comes to questions of caste. Bhadurang is seen as a much more powerful religious leader than, for example, the Shankaracharya. So you have these oral narratives of Bhadurang engaging with Shankaracharya and outwitting him, out-dialoguing with him, he's able to maneuver all these kind of powers that even the Shankaracharya doesn't have. And again, I think these kinds of narratives provide a way to sort of really thinking both in terms of how these descendants of these Dharalas, and they no longer identify themselves as Dharalas, that's the first issue, how they want to see themselves within the context of the nation state. I mean, in a certain sense, the nation, the hegemony and the ideas of the nation state have blown out, but how do they want to see themselves moving forward and in a place, in a world in which they have basically not been accounted for?
So what would you say were the most important things that came up as a result of your fieldwork? You know, what are the major issues that you had to deal with while talking to all these people and finding out oral histories?
Yes. I would say that, for me, the most important, or the serious most important things was the intellectual conversation, intellectual dialogue, and the ways in which these individuals have interpreted and understood the kind of changes that had happened in Gujarat in for the 19th and the 20th century. So in what I was interested in doing and doing the oral histories was to try to understand look at the kind of ways in which nationalism and colonialism have been remembered in the post-colonial period, right? And how these figures of Bhadurang, Ranchoda, Gandhi, of others, are remembered in totality. So at one level, these individuals are very aware of the fact of their own poverty, of the fact that they have lost out in land reforms, for example. They've lost out on land rights, of labor rights. They've also, in many ways, lost out to the kind of alliances that they created with other minority and marginal groups in India, with Harijans, the Adivasis, Muslims, Kshatriyas. They feel that in many ways they didn't benefit due to their class status from the kind of transformations and promises of pretty much all the government that came into power. At another level, I think discursively, they're also sensitive to the fact that they are not part of the history writing. They're not part of the oral narrative. They're not part of the story in which the Indian nation came into being. So in many ways, and also at the level of caste, I think they also recognize their marginal status. And what's in my current research, which I didn't address in the book, is that, for example, that the Criminal Tribes Act, in which the entire Dharala population was criminalized, was revoked by the government of India in 1952, so 5 years after independence. But however, in 1952, all criminal tribes were replaced by the Habitual Offenders Act. All criminal members of criminal tribes are now identified as habitual offenders. And it is estimated that 60 to 80 million habitual offenders in India today. There was one other thing that happened, which was the government of India denotified all the tribes. But one community that was never denotified was the Dalits by the government of India. So they have this kind of awkward liminal space in which they're still not classified as a criminal tribe. Community associations, NGOs that work with criminal tribes don't know that the Dalits, even though they were one of the largest criminal tribes in Western India, were even a criminal tribe. So they've not benefited either from sort of non-government-sponsored projects or government-sponsored projects. And so in many ways, for me, in sort of coming back to your question, thinking about what has meant the most important thing was is highlighting these kinds of issues, and these individuals and groups that I was communicating with and interacting with are fully aware of both the political, the economic, discursive, historical marginalization the community has faced. And so I think for me that was one of the most important things to recognize, that rather than sort of dismissing their ideas, but to actually take them seriously, because no one else in the locality is really trying to take them seriously as having this very specific kind of history, from figures like Gandhi saying you need to erase your past, you need to forget the past, to even government organizations today that don't recognize this past of criminal tribes, to the NGOs that have forgotten that this was a criminal tribe as well. So the continuity, the things that are continuing regarding the legacies of being a habitual offender or criminal tribe continue even today.
That's very interesting. I mean, despite the fact that they were aware that they did not really figure in the written records, and that probably kind of worked to that disadvantage. You mentioned an incident on page 190 and 191, your visit to the shrine of Ranchhod Veera. When they didn't really want to tell you about the, you know, the hidden history behind the shrine. Could you tell us something more about that?
Yes. I think what struck me was that you still have, in attached to the shrine, it's a very informal shrine. And it's, I think what was interesting was that the desire to at least recognize, but yet at the same time make it innocuous such that government officials entering the village would not be would not know of its significance. And in many ways, the state is still seen as possessing this certain kind of power by which it will continue to be marginalized. And so for me, the question was, do I talk about this shrine in history? Because I asked them, should I write about it? Because in a certain sense, what you're arguing is you want to keep it hidden, but you're telling me, and so would this be something that be okay to discuss? And they all said yes, recognizing a certain kind of contradiction in that. But what struck me was that the oral narrative around the hidden shrine was that this figure, Ranchhod Veera, is a figure who still protects these individuals. And they also talk about that the shrine had protected individuals in the past, especially during the colonial period, in which individuals could live independently of the nationalist movement and independently of the nation state. Independently of the colonial state. So it was in that space of the nationalist movement where the Patidars were wanting to have greater controls over these Dalits, where the colonial state was also interested in having greater controls. And you see that what they were arguing is that in this area, in this locality, in this specific area around the shrine, you had the Dalits who were living autonomously, independently. And for these individuals, these are narratives that are extremely powerful. There was a world in the past which lived independently of of all forms of state, and there's a possibility for the future in which the kind of powers the state is evoking and marginalizing these groups perhaps is a way to think about the future. Now, one could argue that this is a potentially utopian vision, but so what? I mean, in a certain sense that you have pretty much every figure who was rising throughout the 20th century in the locality, was, whether it was Gandhi or others, has some kind of utopian vision of a world, right? And so, in a sense, it's a world in which the state does not have power over you, is a world which is a better world, that's continually being articulated through this, through the discussion of this particular shrine, I would argue.
Yeah, and they're actually very adept at controlling the historical record, at, you know, being very selective about what information, like, gets written about them, goes out about them.
Yes. You mean at the time in the pre-independence period or in the post-colonial period?
Well, in the post-colonial period, yeah, like currently, for example.
Well, what I've written about recently is the impact of Hindutva, for example, among the Dharmalas. Mm-hmm. And this is something I touched on in my book. What I was talking about in terms of their, so maybe taking a step back, what I argued in the book was that there was an awareness of these Dharmalas, for example, the powers of the colonial state, documenting their movements, and the desire not to enter the colonial archive, right, of not being monitored, of not being documented. At another level, now, in the post-colonial period, there is a desire to be documented as being, not be a member of a criminal tribe, of being documented as a citizen that possesses certain kinds of rights, of being documented by NGOs so they can get certain kinds of benefits, of rehabilitation, of education, of investment, and so on. But at another level, it's to be documented as someone who makes history. So in a recent article that I've written, that kind of takes the argument of my book into the 21st century, is really trying to look at why the Dharmalas, some Dharmalas, became interested in participating in the 2002 violence as a way of being forever documented as participants in the making of a different kind of nation, right? Instead of the arguments of just being participants in the making of an anti-colonial movement or in the making of a certain kind of nationalism, we find that some Dharmalas are now participating in the making of a certain kind of Hindu nation. And so that's kind of where it's not something I discuss in my book, but it's something that I'm thinking about in terms of, you know, are these early histories of the 19th and 20th century connected to the ways in which Dharmalas, who want to be now identified as makers of history, as individuals who cannot be forgotten for their participation in a certain kind of violence, in a certain kind of innovation. Whereas everyone else seems to have not acknowledged their presence, this is the kind of nation in which some of the Dharmalas are now pushing for. And I don't have a complete answer. I mean, it's something that I haven't gone back and sort of done further oral histories in terms of thinking about that. But it is something that's been on mind, that's been on the mind of many scholars since 2002 in terms of how do we account for what's happening in central Gujarat or happened in central Gujarat, kinds of changes that have been happening, both economic, political, historical, and again, at the discursive level. And so, I think, for me, it's recognizing, as you pointed out, right, I mean, at one level, not wanting to be documented, to now want to be part of this kind of narrative, part of this story, which is both a sobering reminder, I think, of, you know, the problems of nationalism, I would say, and the problems of perhaps all forms of nationalism. The nationalism in and of itself is a double-edged sword at one level, offering a certain kind of universal, emancipatory kind of politics, but at another level, having this dark side of political society, as Partha Chatterjee says, exists simultaneously, right? So it's as scholars trying to navigate between the two in terms of thinking about how are we going to understand nationalism in the 21st century.
That was illuminating. It was, I mean, we don't really get to know this sort of thing, I mean, about Gujarat. It's like a very, it's little known history, you know, so I think it's like really fuses historiography and, you know, more theoretical concepts very nicely. But we've taken up a lot of your time. But one final question would be, where do you see your research going from here?
Could you just repeat the last part? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, it's more like this book, you know, it's a good fusion of, you know, historiography and, you know, a socio-cultural study. And obviously, it's got a lot of theoretical models, like, you know, underpinning it. So the issue is, where do you see your research going from here now?
Well, my current, so in addition to sort of writing this follow-up to the book, which I call From Peasant Past to Hindutva Futures, in many ways, it's formed a bridge to my current project on thinking about the impact of Hindutva over the 20th century, which has led me to a book project on the writings of V.D. Savarkar. In terms of his arguments about strategy of creating a Hindu nation, his arguments about both the political realm, the historical, the discursive, and in many ways, I argue that, you know, he understood the what we call cultural hegemony today he understood that very well. As a way of thinking about the division of labor within society to creating a certain type of Hindu nation. One of, you know, things that Inaxa says, renaming spaces, renaming cities, renaming streets to children's education, to history writing, to civil war. All of these, in many ways, were part of his political strategy of thinking about creating a Hindu nation. So in many ways, I think what 2002 has done for many historians, or even if you look at the period between 1992 and 2002, especially in Western India, those who work on either Maharashtra, Gujarat, this decade in many ways has provided a very important kind of recognition and shift in trying to understand, well, how did we get to this point today, which Hindutva, or many arguments of Hindutva, have become mainstream without individuals who recognizing them as mainstream sets of arguments. I think Savarkar provides that optic to understanding kinds of shifts that have taken place. So at one level, you know, I think individuals haven't read Savarkar, because, I mean, and they've read very select articles of his or select texts of his. But for me, it provides a way of thinking about the kinds of changes of the 20th century by which we can explain the kinds of shifts that have taken place. So in many ways, I think it's also a continuity of methodologically in terms of thinking about the movement of ideas, the ways in which people are thinking, in which arguments are received, the ways in which people read certain types of texts, which is exactly what I was trying to do in many ways in terms of thinking about agrarian society in the first book project. This, in many ways, is looking at similar sets of themes in terms of how we get to 2002 or 1992 India. And for me, I think Savarkar provides a certain kind of optic in thinking about it, and hopefully will provide a way in terms of trying to understand the shifts that have taken place within Indian society. Not to legitimate Savarkar's arguments, but to look at the ways in which his arguments have been received. And it's not simply, I would argue, by a handful of individuals who support Hindutva. In fact, many of his arguments are part of mainstream thought. which people oftentimes don't want to acknowledge. They claim that they don't like his arguments, but yet articulate his arguments. And that struck me as something that's very important to try to understand as a way of thinking about, you know, how do we prevent these kinds of events from happening in the future. It's very important not simply to ignore the writing, but actually to read the writing as a way to understand both the inner logic and provide a much more systematic critique of that argument. And that's what my project is trying to do.
Well, that was great. That sounds very different from your current project, but I'm sure it'll be fantastic just the same. Well, thank you for giving so much of your time to the New Books Network. And it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much for having me, and I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, it's a privilege. Goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
So, Fox, that was Vinayak Chaturvedi on Gujarat's peasants and their negotiations with and opposition to the state and local power elites. A great, great book, a cross between a travelogue and a socio-historical study of a people often dubbed apolitical. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.